Welcome to section one of General Principles. In this section, we will discuss cell transport mechanisms and how to apply this information. So let's get started. Now, cellular membranes are composed of phospholipids. Now, in each phospholipid, there's one hydrophilic phosphate head, and this is water soluble, and there are two hydrophobic fatty acid tails, and these tails are lipid soluble. The hydrophobic tails will face each other and form a lipid bilayer. And this makes it so lipid-soluble substances can cross the cell membrane easily, and this is called simple diffusion. And we will elaborate on simple diffusion more in a moment. Now, there are four lipid-soluble substances that can cross the cell membrane via simple diffusion. And these are steroids and all of the hormones that are steroids. Any lipid is lipid-soluble, and oxygen and CO2. If you remember these four substances, and remember that they can travel via simple diffusion, it'll make things much easier in the future. So here's figure 1.1 showing simple diffusion. And here are the phosphate heads, which are hydrophilic, as we've labeled here. And this means they are water loving. And as you can see, the hydrophilic heads will face the outside of the cell and the inside of the cell. And if outside the cell was blood, and the cell that we're referring to is actually a part of the endothelium, then we can see that the hydrophilic heads will interact directly with the blood, and they will be touching the blood. In addition to the hydrophilic phosphate head, there are two hydrophobic fatty acid tails. These fatty acid tails are hydrophobic, which means they are repelled by water. So if there's H2O on either side, of course there is water and blood, then these hydrophobic tails will be repelled by the water. So now you can see that we have this lipid bilayer. So it's two layers of these phosphate tails. And it's this lipid bilayer that makes it possible for lipid-soluble substances to cross the membrane without acting on a receptor. For example, lipids, steroids, oxygen, and CO2 can cross very easily through this lipid bilayer. So we talked about lipid-soluble substances being able to cross the cell membrane via simple diffusion. Now let's talk about water-soluble substances, and these are repelled by the lipid bilayer. Things that are repelled by the lipid bilayer are charged molecules. For example, H2O, sodium chloride, and glucose. And we'll explain how H2O and glucose are charged. So it's obvious that sodium and chloride are charged. It's a little less apparent that glucose and water are charged. So we'll discuss that in the next slide. Other things that cannot cross the cell membrane are large particles. For example, proteins. And this makes sense because if it's just too large to fit in between the phosphate heads or the cells of the cell membrane, then it won't be able to get into the cell. So let's focus our attention on water, or H2O. You can see on each hydrogen atom there's a partial positive charge. And this is where that charge comes from, which makes it hard for the water molecules to cross the cell membrane. And we've indicated that with this arrow. Also notice that the oxygen in H2O has a partial negative charge. And this makes it so it also cannot cross easily. So in general, just think of water as being charged and can't cross the cell membrane easily. So now, let's focus on sodium and chloride. These have obvious charges, so they're going to be repelled by the cellular membrane. Finally, glucose has oxygen, which has a partial negative charge. And this partial negative charge makes it difficult for glucose to cross the cell membrane. Up to this point, we have talked a little bit about simple diffusion. So let's define this term more now. Simple diffusion means that there is no carrier for the substance. In other words, there is no protein transporter. Also, there is no energy required. This is a passive process. And lastly, substances which cross the cell membrane via simple diffusion always follow a concentration gradient. And recall that substances that can cross the cell membrane via simple diffusion are steroids, lipids, oxygen, and CO2. So now let's talk about carrier-mediated transport. And if transport is carrier-mediated, that means, well, it has a carrier, which means there is a protein transporter. Now it's very important to recognize that it is conducted via a protein, which means that it can be saturated, meaning that transport can actually reach a maximum, or TM, transport maximum. Also, because it is a protein, the transporter can experience competition. And there are three types of carrier-mediated transport that you need to be aware of. First is facilitated diffusion. which is a lot like simple diffusion, except that it doesn't just cross the cell membrane freely, it goes through a transporter. Second is primary active transport, which requires ATP, because the substance will flow against a concentration gradient, so it needs energy in the form of ATP. Now, secondary active transport is very similar to primary active transport in that it does require ATP, but it's secondary. And we'll explain what we mean by this later in this lecture. So now let's focus more on facilitated diffusion. Of course, because it is facilitated, that means there is a carrier or a protein transporter. Now, there is no energy required, which makes it passive. And recall, another type of passive transport is simple diffusion. So whenever you see the word diffusion, you should always think of passive. And because it is diffusion, that means it will follow a concentration gradient. Now think of almost any substance that cannot enter via simple diffusion can use facilitated diffusion. Now some substances may use primary active transport or secondary active transport, but most of these substances can also use facilitated diffusion, meaning if there's a transporter, then it can follow along its gradient to transport across the cell membrane. And if you want to go in the opposite direction of the concentration gradient, then you can use primary or secondary active transport. However, any substance that cannot use simple diffusion can use facilitated diffusion, and this will make more sense in a moment. So here's the cell membrane, and here's a channel embedded in this membrane. Think of substances that can use a facilitating transporter as anything that cannot enter the cell via simple diffusion. In other words, think of glucose, an example we used before, water, or H2O, sodium, and chloride. Now, these couldn't transport across the cell via simple diffusion because of their charge. Now, these substances were used as examples of things that could not transport across the cell membrane via simple diffusion. So we're using them to highlight the fact that they can come across the cell via facilitated diffusion. As mentioned on the previous slide, facilitated diffusion of a substance means it can pass from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration. For example, if the substance is high on the outside of the cell and low on the inside of the cell, then the substance can travel down its concentration gradient. Also keep in mind that the concentration gradient can be reversed. In other words, it would be high inside the cell and low outside the cell. So the transport would be backwards. In other words, leaving the cell. So now let's do some questions to apply this. Hemoglobin carries oxygen to the capillaries. How does oxygen leave the capillaries to enter the tissue? It's important to recognize that oxygen can traverse cell membranes via simple diffusion, meaning only a concentration gradient is necessary to pull oxygen into the cells of the tissue. Now, oxygen is low in the tissues and high in the arteries and capillaries. So oxygen will freely transfer from where it is in high concentration outside the cell, and then it can go into the cell where it's in low concentration. As a side note, carbon dioxide is also transported at this junction. However, carbon dioxide is in high concentration inside the cell, and carbon dioxide is in low concentration in the blood. Now, it's in high concentration inside the tissues because it is a product of metabolism. So it can transfer from where it is in high concentration to where it is in low concentration. And the CO2 can then be sent to the lungs to be exhaled. Now, gas exchange is discussed thoroughly in the pulmonology chapter. The point here is to recognize the molecules that can traverse cells via simple diffusion. These include oxygen and carbon dioxide, which we've discussed, as well as lipid-soluble substances, such as steroids and lipids. So now let's do another question. In an experimental setting, a cell does not have any protein transporters. The researcher notices that some substances can enter the cell and others cannot. Will glucose be able to enter the cell? Now recall that there are substances that must have a transporter to cross the cell membrane. This includes everything except for those four lipid-soluble substances that we mentioned. Now these are lipid-soluble and small, so they can transport via simple diffusion. So oxygen, CO2, steroids, and lipids. Now, this is not a hard and fast rule, but it is an excellent rule of thumb that will help you rock these types of questions on step one. So remember these. But the question specifically asks about glucose. Can glucose enter via simple diffusion? No, it cannot. It is too large and it has polar moieties, which is another reason it cannot enter. so glucose cannot enter via simple diffusion. Now here's figure 1.3 again, showing facilitated diffusion. Recall that anything that is not oxygen, carbon dioxide, lipids, or steroids must have a protein transporter, such as this one, in order to enter the cell. And here we just have a few examples, glucose, water, sodium chloride, and these can transfer into the cell or outside of the cell via diffusion. In other words, they can follow their concentration gradient. Now, this brings us to another important point. Just because we state that these substances can use facilitated diffusion does not mean that they always use facilitated diffusion. For example, in the next few slides, you will see that sodium may need to move against its concentration gradient and actually exit the cell where it is in high concentration. Facilitated diffusion cannot allow something to move against its gradient. Now that brings us to active transport. So let's jump into that now. Now primary active transport means that there is a carrier, in other words, a protein transporter, just like facilitated diffusion. However, unlike facilitated diffusion, primary active transport uses ATP, making it active. Now some examples of primary active transporters end with ATPase. For example, sodium potassium ATPase, hydrogen ATPase, and calcium ATPase. And the ACE in ATPase just means that ATP was broken into ADP and phosphate, and that phosphate bond was used to create energy. Now the term primary active transport implies that the substance is moving against its gradient. After all, if it was moving down its natural concentration gradient, then facilitated diffusion would be a much better option because it doesn't require energy. So when you think of primary active transport, think of something that's moving against its concentration gradient. So now here is figure 1.4 showing primary active transport. And there's a protein transporter. And there's a high concentration of sodium outside the cell. ATP can input energy to force the sodium that's low inside the cell out to where it's in high concentration. At the same time, potassium can enter the cell where its concentration is high. It's low outside the cell. Nevertheless, it's brought in to the cell. And this is because of the ATP. And this is primary active transport in a nutshell. It is carrier mediated because there is a protein. It is not passive, it is active because ATP was involved. It moves substances against their concentration gradient. Another high yield example is hydrogen being transported against its gradient from the parietal cells in the stomach. So in other words, the stomach has a lot of acid in it. So we'll just pretend each one of these sodiums is acid. And the parietal cells of the stomach want to send more acid out, and so they can use an active transporter to pump it out into the stomach lumen to keep the chyme acidic. Now let's discuss secondary active transport. Now just like primary active transport and facilitated diffusion, secondary active transport has a carrier or a protein transporter, and ATP is required. And it moves against a concentration gradient, but it follows the sodium concentration gradient that was created by primary active transport. So if we look at figure 1.5, we can illustrate this. As mentioned in the previous slide, secondary active transport, which is on this left side, occurs as a result of the actions of primary active transport, this right side. ATP can act on a sodium potassium pump, which we're demonstrating right here, creating a high concentration of sodium outside the cell. And then sodium can then flow down its concentration gradient back into the cell. When sodium does flow down its gradient with this secondary active transporter, it can allow another substance to flow against its concentration gradient. For example, glucose can be high in the cell and low on the outside of the cell, but this transport mechanism allows glucose to flow into the cell because of the power of the sodium gradient. Now we mentioned that sodium can flow down its concentration gradient with another substance, such as glucose, but it's important to know that this sodium can also be used to exchange for something, for example, calcium. So sodium, where it's in high concentration outside the cell, can flow into the cell where it's in low concentration. And as sodium enters, calcium can exit. So this calcium is in high concentration outside the cell and low inside the cell in this particular example. So it's flowing against its concentration gradient because of the power of the sodium gradient. Now this whole process is called secondary active transport. Active because it required ATP, which is what created the sodium gradient in the first place. Secondary, meaning that it relied on this primary active transport. And transport, meaning it used a protein. Secondary active transport. Now let's do some questions to apply this. A researcher determines that glucose is high in the cell, but is still brought into the cell against its concentration gradient. No ATP is used at the transporter that glucose uses to enter the cell. What type of transport was used for this glucose? Now we are trying to determine which type of transport was used. Recall there is simple diffusion, facilitated diffusion, primary active transport, and secondary active transport. We know that a protein transporter is being used because it's glucose, meaning it's not a steroid, a lipid, oxygen, or CO2. So we know that it's not using simple diffusion. So it must be using one of these three that uses a protein transporter. We also know that glucose is moving into the cell against its concentration gradient, as is mentioned in the question stem. This means that we can rule out facilitated diffusion. So it must be primary active transport or secondary active transport. The question stem states that no ATP is used at the glucose transporter, so we can rule out primary active transport, leaving us with secondary active transport. Let's do another question. Now this is a long question, but don't be intimidated. We'll take this one step at a time and demonstrate very high yield principles. Measurements are taken for transport of substance A and substance B across distinct and separate cell membranes. Throughout the experiment, both substances are kept low in their respective cells, while concentration increases outside the cell. Transfer of substance A increases proportionally as the concentration gradient is increased. However, transport of substance B does not increase even though its concentration gradient is increased. One of the substances is a steroid hormone. Is the steroid likely to be substance A or B? So let's draw this question out to make it more clear. So we're going to split this screen into two halves. And we have cell A over here and then cell membrane B. And substance A is high outside the cell and substance B is high outside of its cell. Concentration of both substances in the cell is kept low throughout the experiment. So we'll draw a down arrow to demonstrate that. So this means that there is a continual gradient favoring each substance to enter its cell. Now later in the experiment, concentrations of each substance outside the cell is increased. So let's draw this once more. So we can see that there's an increase in concentration of B outside the cell. We'll do the same thing with A. The concentration is increased outside here. As a result of this increase in concentration outside the cell, transport of substance A has increased. So we'll draw extra arrows to demonstrate that. However, even with an increased gradient, substance B does not increase but stays the same. So we'll just draw one arrow. The question asks, which substance is a steroid hormone? Substance A or substance B? Now before we answer that, we need to know why substance B didn't increase its rate of transfer even though its concentration gradient increased. Now the key is that transporter proteins can be saturated. Now the only type of transport that cannot be saturated is the transport that does not rely on a protein. Now the question stem states that as concentration gradient increased, the rate of substance A increased. This implies that substance A does not have a transport maximum, so no TM. Therefore, it does not rely on a protein transporter. So in answer to our question, which substance is likely to be the steroid hormone? Well, we would guess substance A. Recall that steroids, lipids, oxygen, and CO2 do not rely on protein transporters. Instead, they freely follow their concentration gradient via simple diffusion, which is substance A. Now, the last thing we're going to talk about is receptor-mediated endocytosis. Now, these rely on proteins, which are on the ligand that bind to proteins on the cell surface. The cell membrane will then form a coated vesicle that is then ingested into the cell. Some high-yield examples of receptor-mediated endocytosis is iron in the serum, which forms a transferrin iron complex that can stimulate this endocytosis. There's also LDLs, or low-density lipoproteins, and these will stimulate the LDLRs, or low-density lipoprotein receptors on cells, and then be ingested via endocytosis. And lastly, there's EGFs, or epidermal growth factors, which will stimulate the EGFRs, or epidermal growth factor receptors. So here's figure 1.7, showing receptor-mediated endocytosis. And here's the cell membrane with the lipid bilayer. So now we can see that low-density lipoprotein, or LDL, can attach to the LDLR on the cell membrane. Now once bound, the cell membrane can form an invagination, ultimately leading to a protein-coated vesicle. So we've demonstrated the LDLR receptor with its ligand here. The same thing can happen with EGF and the EGFR, which we've demonstrated here. And also the iron transferrin complex can attach to the cell and be taken in, which we've demonstrated with this. So let's just do one last question to apply this concept. The LDL receptor is dysfunctional in a certain patient. What will happen to the intracellular level of LDL in the adipose tissue of this patient? Now basically, this cell is unable to recognize LDLs because the LDLR is broken. This means that endocytosis of LDLs, or low-density lipoproteins, will be decreased. So we'll have decreased LDL transport. This means that endocytosis of LDLs will be decreased. And the result will be that there will be decreased LDL in the adipose tissue, and it will remain high in the serum. Now, this is an actual condition called hypercholesterolemia type 2A, which leads to a whole host of problems because this LDL that's high in the serum will go to places of the body it should not go. And that concludes the section.